From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on April 10th when the Pulitzer Committee announced the 2017 Pulitzer Prizes. Now, some of the winners were big publications that you've heard of. But something interesting happened this year, something that caught our eye that will drive the story this hour. And that is this. The Pulitzer Prize Committee decided to award Pulitzers to the smallest newspaper ever to win one, the Storm Lake Times in Iowa. Tiny little publication. You'll hear in a moment just how small the circulation is, but just how big and important the work is. The Pulitzer Committee also awarded the Charleston Gazette-Mail in Charleston, West Virginia. This was not a case of just looking at the big markets and the well-known names. The Pulitzer Committee wanted to award journalism at a time where investigative work is more important than ever, especially with some papers closing or pulling back their print runs, and they did not discriminate based on size or location. That had us thinking about the value of newspapers, about the importance of what these publications do. And we're going to start with the smallest. You're going to hear some of the winners this hour. We're going to start in Storm Lake, Iowa. Art Cullen is the name behind that paper. In fact, it's a small staff. It's mostly family. It's mostly the Cullen family. Art is the writer of the editorials, and he and his family do a lot of investigative research as well. The Pulitzer Committee awarded Art for commentary writing based on the investigative reporting, the research that was being done there, and in particular, the writing about Big Ag, how agriculture was running roughshod in parts of Iowa with very little regulation, kind of trampling over things. So I want to start by welcoming Art, who's on the line with us. And I think there are a lot of people across this country who have been, I'm afraid to say, a little indifferent about the fate of newspapers, that they see newspapers either closing outright, shutting down shop, or maybe paring back the number of days they're publishing to try to survive. And they're going, well, I wish print would stick around, but then they're not subscribing anymore. And I want to start by asking how things are going for you at your operation.
Well, I'd say that our circulation is steady, and I'd say that's true at most community newspapers. Since most rural communities are actually shrinking in population, circulation will tend to shrink with the population. In stable rural communities, paid circulation is stable. That's not true in metro newspapers, like the Des Moines Register in Iowa, our state capital, or the Kansas City Star. But community newspapers have been, pretty solid since the implosion that began roughly 2000 or even before that. However, we're starting to see deterioration in the community newspaper market, especially in terms of ad revenue, the rural mom-and-pop businesses that used to support community newspapers have been replaced by Walmart and big-box stores that don't advertise in community newspapers. So I'd say that's a real stress point right now for smaller newspapers, is just watching their retail advertising base fade away.
Well, why don't you paint the picture for our listeners? The Storm Lake Times in Storm Lake, Iowa. How big a community? How big a newspaper?
Storm Lake, Iowa is a regional trade center in rural northwest Iowa, somewhat an isolated rural community. We're 3 hours from any place. Omaha, Des Moines, Sioux Falls. We're in the center of those three metro areas, and we're about 4.5 hours from the Twin Cities. The newspaper, and this is a meatpacking town, heavily populated by immigrants. About 88% of our elementary school are children of color, and we're about 21 languages are spoken in this community. So it's a very diverse community of about 15,000 people, and the newspaper circulation is about 3,000 circulation, and I say steady. We're a twice-a-week publication, and we concentrate solely on local news.
And it's a lot of Cullens on the staff. How many total staff members?
Well, let's see. There's put out a publication with another brother of ours in Texas called The Progressive Populist. It's a twice-a-month national political publication.
And there you are, Art. 3,000 circulation, 5 people on staff of the Storm Lake Times, and a Pulitzer Prize winner. Did you ever think that that sentence would be said?
No, honestly. The whole Pulitzer thing was quite a surprise to me, and I think to everybody here, obviously. And yeah, it has been a whirlwind since that announcement on April 10th. But the newspaper is still pretty much the same as it always has been, and Storm Lake is much the same
sure.
as it always has been—a quiet little community along a 3,000-acre glacial lake.
Well, and I got to know here. I mean, how does the Pulitzer Committee let you know that you won?
Well, I was there was a live stream on the Pulitzer website at pulitzer.org and on April 10th, and I was aware that they would have this live stream at 2 p.m. And so I just tuned in on my computer here in the office, and they announced the winners to the public at that time, and that was when I found out that we won.
And what was your reaction at that moment?
Is this taped?
this is pre-recorded, yes.
Yeah, so anyway, they have there's 21 journalism categories, and editorial writing was number 18, and so, they're going through with the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, ProPublica, the New York Daily News, Chicago Tribune, and then they say, Peggy Noonan for commentary from the Wall Street Journal, and then there's number 18 is editorial writing, and as they said, Art Cullen from the Storm Lake Times, and I sprung out of my chair and screamed, holy and to my brother John, and I said, we won, and John said, what did we win? I said, we won the freaking Pulitzer. And John hugged each other, and I hugged each other for the first time in our lives, I think.
Well, Art, before we get into just a short conversation about what it was that you were writing about that the Pulitzer Committee thought was so important, I do want to ask you if you agree with some of the sentiment that I've been reading since you're winning this prize. Some have pointed to you, Eric Iyer from West Virginia, and a few other publications as examples that the Pulitzer Committee knows that this country needs print journalism as a kind of watchdog, as a kind of support for communities, especially small communities, and that this is a validation of sort of the necessity of that work. Do you agree with that?
I'm not sure if I do, because that would imply that the Pulitzer Board was sort of making a political decision, and I don't think that that's the case.
Okay.
What I think, I mean, small newspapers, I believe we might be the smallest newspaper ever to win a Pulitzer. I'm not sure, but I think so. But small newspapers have won before. 20 years ago, the Ames Tribune from Iowa, Michael Gartner won for editorial writing. That was a 9,000 circulation newspaper. And but they were just beautiful editorials. And, the Hungry Horse News in Whitefish, Montana won for the Pulitzer for photography back in the 1960s or 70s. And then, Charleston, West Virginia and us this year. It might just be an anomaly because the opioid story is a huge national story, and the Charleston paper just happened to do it better than any other paper in the country. And, environmental issues are also a really hot topic in America right now, and the Paris Climate Agreement and all that, and so maybe our editorial writing entry just happened to hit on those themes that are big to America, and it involved dark money in politics, in the court system, and conflict between urban and rural areas, and so it had all the kind of the recipe for an award-winning entry, whether we were a big paper or small. So I don't know, but I respect that opinion that maybe they were making a statement. But on the other hand, I think you could argue that the Charleston and Storm Lake papers won in their own regard.
Absolutely. I certainly don't mean to sort of take away from the actual quality of the writing.
No, I didn't take it that way. But I guess what I would say is it would imply a political decision on the part of the Pulitzer jury and board, and I just don't know that they felt that way.
Okay. Yeah, no, but let me ask it maybe a different way then. You know, when we look at, here's what the Pulitzer Committee said about why Art Cullen of the Storm Lake Times in Storm Lake, Iowa, was chosen for this award. Quote, "For editorials fueled by tenacious reporting, impressive expertise, and engaging writing that successfully challenged powerful corporate agricultural interests in Iowa," end quote. So let's say the Storm Lake Times goes away. Let's say small papers go away. What happens in this country when those kind of publications go away?
Taxpayers in Storm Lake, Iowa, would have no idea what their Board of Supervisors was doing, and whether they were being encumbered by a huge agricultural pollution lawsuit, which was the issue at hand here. And were it not for our reporting, the public wouldn't have known that that agribusiness was financing our county's defense of this lawsuit that was filed against us by the Des Moines Water Works. And I don't think our county would have an understanding of how what seemingly a pastoral landscape is actually directing poison to the Raccoon River into the drinking water in for 500,000 people in Des Moines. When you look at the green landscape today, you can't imagine nitrate flowing into the Raccoon River, but it's there. And so people just wouldn't know about those things if it weren't for the Storm Lake Times.
And so let me just read a little bit from just one example. And to our listeners, at first glance, this might seem pretty parochial. We're talking about a water issue and a part of Iowa. But I do think what Art is saying here is kind of universal, that these kinds, every community could have its own environmental issues or questions on, you know, if the public is being protected in certain ways. And it just so happened that the Pulitzer Committee was impressed with what Art and the Storm Lake Times had done to help alert and protect the community there. So here's from one of Art's pieces called BV is Losing the Public. And he writes, quote, "Anyone with eyes and a nose knows in his gut that Iowa has the dirtiest surface water in America. It is choking the waterworks in the Gulf of Mexico. It is causing oxygen deprivation in northwest Iowa glacial lakes. It has caused us to spend millions upon millions trying to clean up Storm Lake, the victim of more than a century of explosive soil erosion. Everyone knows it's not the city sewer plant causing the problem, and most of us recognize that this is not just nature at work, busily releasing nitrates into the water. 92% of surface water pollution comes from row crop production, an incontroverted fact from the court case." And then you go on to say this about the political leaders charged with dealing with this. You say, "The solution demands that we quit farming into the ditch and over the fence line. If we left 10% of Iowa's marginal land fallow, the nitrate problem would disappear. Iowa State University research proves it. However, Iowa's political system is immune from such numbers. The Buena Vista County Board of Supervisors appears to have a religious tenet that drainage districts shall not be regulated." End quote. You go on to say a lot more. I want to ask you, first of all, how the Board of Supervisors reacted to that piece. What do you remember about that?
Well, they, you know, spit nails. They didn't invite me to their Thanksgiving dinner and or their holiday party. And but that's all right. And but the argument in the court case was essentially over: shall agriculture be regulated as a point source polluter, just as a municipal sewage plant is? And what happened is the lawsuit was dismissed on a motion for summary judgment by a federal district court judge. And so the verdict is yes, no, there is no way to regulate agricultural runoff under the Clean Water Act of 1972. So agriculture is free to fertilize as it will, where it will. And that's the status quo. What our role was is we at least were able to explain it to the public and demonstrate to the public that we have a problem here, and that the terms of the conversation are starting to change, in that Governor Terry Branstad, a Farm Bureau Republican, proposed a multi-billion-dollar fund to clean up Iowa's surface waters. Now, that fund failed to materialize in the legislature, but it just shows that the conversation has been changing in Iowa, and that we are becoming at least aware and acknowledging that we have a problem and that we are polluting the Gulf of Mexico. And so at least we're starting to pay attention to it, which is better than what we could have said 10 years ago.
Finally, I want to ask a little bit about following the money. You wrote a piece called Who Pays the Wizard? And, I think what you're writing and reporting has done is demonstrate how important it is to understand who's paying whom and following the money. And I just want you, if you could, Art, to elaborate a little bit on something that the Pulitzer Committee said, that your editorials were based on, quote, impressive reporting. And so it wasn't just the quality of the writing, but it was also the importance of some of the legwork that was being done that undergirds your editorial writing. And you're a small operation. It takes a lot of work to understand these issues, to dig into them. And that's something that I'm a little fearful that journalism is getting a little away from, sometimes just with time demands, sometimes with experience demands. How important do you think it is to sort of train young journalists on how to follow the money, how to get the answers you need on these kind of questions?
Yeah, well, in this case, the reporter was my son, Tom.
Yeah, yeah.
He's 24, and he graduated from the University of Northern Iowa with an economics degree. And so he was actually perfectly suited to pursue this story. He had thought about going to law school himself, and he has a logical mind, and he has a command of numbers, and he can add and subtract. And so he was well suited to this story. And it was basically going and asking the Board of Supervisors, who's paying your attorney fees? And they refused to tell us. And then we engaged with the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, a nonprofit in Des Moines that argues for transparency in government. And they wrote several letters jawboning the Board of Supervisors to release their attorney billings and to tell us who was paying the bills, and they still refused. But we did convince the board to sever their relationship with this dark money fund, and so we were able to get that dark money out of the federal courts process. But the basic reporting was just going and just having the fortitude to walk up to the county supervisors and their lawyers, including their start shirt lawyers in Des Moines and Washington, and just basically ask them, how much does it cost? And that's the basic thing you learn in college journalism class. The first question you ask is, how much does it cost? And who's paying the bill? That's what I learned when I was 21 years old. And that's what Tom knows at age 24. And it's just that simple. And it's just a matter of whether you want to do that story or not, and whether you recognize the story and you're awake enough to see what the story is in front of you. And I admit that I've missed many big stories that are right under my nose. But that's how this turned into a big story, was just saying, who's paying your bills?
My guest has been Art Cullen of the Storm Lake Times in Storm Lake, Iowa. Might be the smallest publication, the smallest newspaper to win a Pulitzer for editorials that he wrote, and the Pulitzer Committee recognizing the impact of these. And my guess, Art, is in these last 10 or 15 minutes, you have listeners in Western New York who have never heard of Storm Lake, Iowa, who are standing up and cheering at the work you do, because I think the impact is there in your community, but the value of this kind of journalism is national. And I'm glad to see you win the award, and congratulations once again. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about it.
Well, thank you, and go Syracuse.
Our next guest is Eric Ayer, who is a State House reporter for the Charleston Gazette-Mail. Joined that newspaper back in 1998 and wins a Pulitzer Prize for his work on the opioid epidemic, and the Pulitzer Committee recognizing his work for courageous reporting performed in the face of powerful opposition to expose the flood of opioids flowing into depressed West Virginia counties with the highest overdose death rates in the country. Eric Ayer joining me on the program. Welcome, Eric. Thank you. Congratulations to you.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on, Evan.
I asked our last guest, who it was from the Storm Lake Times in Iowa, if he had any idea this was coming and sort of what the reaction was. Can you take me through just that process for you, finding out that you were a Pulitzer winner?
Yeah, it was totally unexpected, and it was overwhelming. I actually, they had gotten a call from NPR asking to kind of stand by, but I didn't think we had a shot. There had been another awards that was given out a couple days before, and we hadn't won that, so I didn't think we had a shot. So I was actually walking outside the building when I got a phone call from a reporter that I used to work with, and he said, "Did you hear the news?" And I said, "What news?" And he said, "The Pulitzer." And I said, "Well, were you a finalist or something?" He said, "No, you won." So I was in total shock, total disbelief, went upstairs. We were, again, unprepared, no champagne or anything like that, like you see in the other photos of the bigger papers.
Right.
Our owner, actually the owner of the paper, she's in her 80s. She got the news at home, and she had to drive and stop at Rite Aid on the way to work to pick up two bottles of champagne. So it was totally unexpected.
Let's kind of go back to the work that led to this. And before we do that, just as I asked our last guest, why don't you tell our listeners about the size of the staff at the Charleston Gazette-Mail and, you know, your circulation, the size of the population you serve.
Yeah, it's about 37,000 circulation. We are the biggest newspaper in the state of West Virginia, but by most standards, we're a small newspaper. It's located in the capital city, Charleston. I don't know. It's had a long history of investigative reporting. We've done a lot of stuff over the years, so we have a motto called Sustained Outrage, and reporters here try to uphold that.
When it comes to where the industry is going, and you know, it's no secret that some newspapers in different places have folded entirely. Some have cut their daily print runs. Some we've seen some consolidation, which I know you understand. You know, what's been the trend there in West Virginia, in Charleston, with the Gazette-Mail, and you know, how do you sort of see the future going for the print industry there?
Well, we face the same obstacles, and I didn't fully answer your question earlier, but we have about 12 city-side reporters, and I think the total newsroom staff is a little bit over 40. We've been very fortunate. We're family-owned. We're not a corporate chain, and they've done a tremendous job in keeping the staff stable. I think they probably have let go only about three people in the entire 18, 19 years that I've been there. The family ownership is a real way to kind of stave off some of those economic pressures, but they face those same pressures, declining circulation. It's just a real struggle, and this Pulitzer has been a real shot in the arm for a small newspaper like ours.
Has the community responded to that award? I mean, does it impact circulation? Does it impact anything else?
You know, it really hasn't. You know, we've read about the New York Times and all their coverage and Washington Post getting a boost. I don't think it's impacted circulation, but it's given sort of a pride to the community. And I say that with mixed feelings. I mean, obviously this issue is so serious, and it's about, you know, people dying and overdose. But communities kind of rallied around the paper. Run into a lot of people I haven't known and congratulating me, and also met a lot of new people as well.
Let me read from one of the pieces that the Pulitzer Committee cited in giving you this award, and then we can talk about how you went about this work. This particular piece titled 780 million pills, 1,728 deaths. Follow the pills and you'll find the overdose deaths. The trail of painkillers leads to West Virginia's southern coalfields, to places like Kermit, population 392. There, out-of-state drug companies shipped nearly 9 million highly addictive and potentially lethal hydrocodone pills over 2 years to a single pharmacy in the Mingo County town. In 6 years, drug wholesalers showered the state with 780 million hydrocodone and oxycodone pills, while 1,728 West Virginians fatally overdosed on those two painkillers, a Sunday Gazette Mail investigation found. The unfettered shipments amount to 433 pain pills for every man, woman, and child in West Virginia, end quote. So those are staggering numbers. and a huge issue in a state that's kind of sprawling. I mean, Eric, I worked there for a few years.
Right.
It's a lot of territory to cover, and you know, you've got to make decisions on, are you going to go down to Kermit? Are you going to get people to talk to you? You know, how are you going to kind of go about this? So take me through your process as a reporter and how you decided to attack this story.
Well, there was a kind of a lengthy legal battle to get some records that was part of a lawsuit against drug wholesalers, and we were able to get those records unsealed. And from that point, we were able to file what's called Freedom of Information Act requests for public records, and we were able to get DEA data. And I think that's what made the story. We could finally put a number to the problem. I mean, it was clear that there was a flood of prescription opioids into West Virginia. And we decided to follow them into individual counties and then to pharmacies and then to families. But it was the numbers. We could really, you know, put a definitive number on what had happened to our state.
When it comes to talking to everyone from law enforcement to retired delegates to people being impacted, how did you go about, you know, fleshing out those personal stories here?
Well, we actually went down to southern West Virginia. We thought, you know, that was the key, because that there was a disproportionate number of pain pills to the poor rural counties in southern West Virginia, the coal fields, as you mentioned, and those same counties had the highest drug overdose death rates in the nation. So I contacted some drug counselors, and they put me in touch with some families, and we profiled one family, but the thing that was striking is that in some of these families you had, you know, a father and a daughter, brother and a sister, both who had died of overdoses. It was that prevalent, and that was particularly heartbreaking, to see these families torn apart where there was one overdose death, more than one overdose death in a single family.
When it comes to the spread of opioids, heroin addiction and opioids, I mean, it's certainly touching Rochester, Western New York. I don't know that it's not hitting anywhere right now. It is a remarkable problem. And just last week on the program, we had a listener call and ask the Monroe County Sheriff here in Western New York, generally, is there a single reason why? Why are people turning to this? We've seen reporters who travel the country like Chris Arnotti say that this is a result of hopelessness, of job loss, of industries closing, you know, among other things. Have you alighted on a single kind of a cause or kind of a common theme for why people are turning on to this kind of addiction?
Yeah, I think you hit it correctly. The anecdotal evidence we hear is, you know, people in car accidents or people in coal mining accidents, things like that, get hurt on the job. They go to a legitimate doctor. They get, you know, a legitimate prescription, and they get addicted, and they wound up going. We had the period here where we had all the pain clinics run amok, rogue pain clinics hooked up with rogue pharmacies, and just were churning out prescriptions by the millions. And then, you know, as that was tightened up, as that was clamped down on, then there was the switch, morphine molecule being the same with OxyContin and heroin, and people made the switch to heroin, and now the heroin's laced with fentanyl, and the problem just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And our drug overdose death rates, which are already number one in the nation, have gotten increased by 20% last year. So it's solutions or nothing promising on the horizon. It's just been 1 year after another of climbing overdose death statistics.
And you know, your readers might wonder, well, how is it that we have this many pills? How could this flood be happening? You addressed that in another piece that the Pulitzer Committee cited and flagged and sort of lauded you for. The piece called Pill Rules Not Enforced, and I'll just read a little bit into that and we can talk about that. You write, tucked into the West Virginia Code of State Rules, you'll find a three-sentence regulation designed to keep in check the flow of prescription pills into the state. The rule directs wholesale distributors to set up systems to identify suspicious orders for highly addictive narcotics. It requires the wholesalers to report those questionable orders to the pharmacy board. And the regulation spells out what orders should be flagged, those of unusual size, orders deviating substantially from a normal pattern, and orders of unusual frequency. But the rule, which has the force and effect of state law, wasn't on the pharmacy board's radar when the pain pills were pouring into southern West Virginia, and the drug companies, for years, ignored it. The pharmacy board's executive director, David Potters, said, quote, "It's not been an item that's ever been enforced by the board." end quote. That piece, to me, was a wonderful explanation for how this happens in the first place. But when you write that, Eric, is the goal to kind of put this out there in the world and sort of let the population and lawmakers kind of do something with it? Are you trying to affect change? Are you assuming that the drug industry itself will respond? You know, what's the goal of a piece like that?
Well, before the main stories got published, they did take action. The Board of Pharmacy, after I started questioning them about that, they imposed new rules where they're giving the suspicious order reports or requiring the suspicious order reports be given to the Attorney General's office and to the West Virginia State Police. It was bizarre when I first started asking about that, you know, the tracking of suspicious orders. They brought out two giant banker's boxes full of suspicious order reports. Now, these were after 2012. Before 2012, nobody had submitted them at all. And what happened in 2012 is the Attorney General filed a lawsuit against the drug wholesalers. So two of them, actually only two of more than a dozen, started submitting the suspicious order reports. But there was no cataloging of them. There was no tracking of them. Essentially, they just stayed in the box and were put on a shelf. I asked for one company, and they said that 8 months of the suspicious orders for that one company were missing. So I was just stunned that nothing was going on with these reports. They were just gathering dust at the Board of Pharmacy's office.
What's the state of the opioid epidemic today? I was going to ask what progress has been made, but, you know, sort of set the landscape for me now. What's going on?
Sure. The big thing going on right now is a big fight between counties, cities, and the drug wholesalers. The counties and cities, after the articles came out, started filing lawsuits against the drug wholesalers. There's probably almost two dozen counties that have either filed a suit or have announced plans to file a suit. And there's a vicious battle going on between the wholesalers to try to snuff out these lawsuits before, you know, they spread. There's, you know, talk that could spread to other states, that type of thing. The drug wholesalers have hired former U.S. attorneys to put them on staff as staff attorneys to try to convince these counties and cities either to not file the lawsuits or to just dismiss them. It's going to be a real dogfight. It kind of reminds me a little bit of the tobacco litigation back in the 80s and 90s. It could become that much of a big thing.
And so before I let you go, as we talk to Eric Ayer, a Pulitzer winner for investigative reporting for the Charleston Gazette-Mail in Charleston, West Virginia, for his work on the opioid epidemic there, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the legwork and the time required, because I'm not sure, you know, the average listener and the average reader fully appreciates that. And I've been a little critical of my former industry, commercial television news, not across the board. There's some wonderful people doing great investigative work. But often that's an industry where you come in the morning, not exactly sure what you're going to do, and you, quote unquote, turn something same day. That's very different than spending weeks or months or even years working on a single story or at least a series of stories within a single framework. Can you give me a sense for how much work this is and the kind of work that you do on an ongoing basis to prepare you to write these kind of stories with the knowledge needed to have it right, to be sure that what you're reporting is accurate?
Sure. I started covering the story about 3.5 years ago with stories about the Attorney General's ties to the pharmaceutical industry, and I've been following it. You know, I have other responsibilities. I'm a State House reporter, so I'm not sure exactly how it breaks down, but probably about 30 stories on this issue a year and probably 170 on other issues related to the legislature and state agencies, that type of thing. But from the time we probably got the Drug Enforcement Administration data, probably a month and a half before the story appeared. So I spent a couple weeks going through the data, sorting through it, looking at the numbers, and then went down and did some interviews in southern West Virginia, and then took about a week to write. So it was probably about a month-long process. But during that period, although I wasn't producing the number of stories I normally produce, I was still writing other stories about other issues.
And so do you at least feel, I don't know if comfort's the right word, but some foundational support that says, you know, take your time. This is going to take a long time to get what you need for the story. And I don't know if you felt any pressure to get something produced by a certain date, or was it, look, come to us when you've got it done?
Yeah, I mean, there was, when I originally had the DEA data, there was a sort of a expectation that I was going to turn it around in a couple days, and I said, no, let's take our time, let's do this right, and I had full support from our editors and our ownership to do it right. And it seemed to have paid off. I mean, there was a lot of, when this story appeared back in December, it was the number one story that we've ever had in terms of page views and shares on Facebook and social media. So it really shined a light on the issue.
And so finally, when it comes to the future of this industry, I will ask you kind of a two-parter here. Are you an optimist, or do you fear that, you know, when our grandkids and their grandkids are getting up in the morning, that there are no more newspapers? How do you feel about the future of the industry?
Oh, gosh. I don't think it's a particularly bright future, but I think investigative reporting and reporting like this will certainly have a place. I think it might be in a different format. I think some of the nonprofit news organizations are doing real well, that have foundation support. So I think this type of work will live on, but the hard copy, the paper copy, I can't see, more than a decade out, that too many places like ours. Now we're doing better than, I think it's the mid-sized papers, the Atlantas, the Charlottes, the Cleveland, those type of markets that are struggling even harder than we are. So I think this kind of work will live on, but the newspaper industry is really struggling now, and it's been that way for years. But certainly hope that somebody finds a way to keep newspapers alive.
And I hope that we continue to have fearless reporting. I just wanted to close by asking you, did you get any pushback, or whether it was the industry or anybody else who was upset with what you were doing?
Yeah, I mean, they felt that there wasn't enough coverage of the fact that they do a lot of good things, cancer drugs, that type of thing, that they distribute, you know, blood pressure medicine, all those other types of things. So there's been a lot of pushback. There's been certainly a lot of more pushback against these lawsuits, which really attack their bottom line.
Congratulations once again. Did you ever think that you'd be a Pulitzer winner?
Not really. I mean, I just kind of been kind of grinding it out over 18 years. I've done a lot of this type of work on other issues. Somebody joked that it was more or less, you know, I've been doing this for like 30 years, so it was more or less a career achievement award.
Thank goodness you do what you do, Eric, and you and your colleagues across the country. Our listeners on this program know I'm an unabashed supporter of print journalism. I don't apologize for it. I think it is vital to so many different parts of our public and civic life, and I'm so glad to see the Pulitzer Committee shining the light, not just on the big papers, which deserve it at times, but also on Charleston and Storm Lake, Iowa, and organizations like this that are just vital to these communities. So thanks again, congratulations, and we appreciate the time.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
All right, so you've heard a couple of Pulitzer Prize winners in the newspaper industry, and we want to conclude our conversation this hour with a conversation with a local education reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle. It's Justin Murphy, who is in studio with me now. Always nice to have you. How are you?
Hey, Evan. How are you doing?
I'm very good, and I enjoyed the conversations with Art and Eric for a number of reasons, but I'm first of all curious to know, when you found out about, everybody sort of follows the Pulitzers, but when you see these smaller papers get recognized, a lot of headlines about it, what was your first reaction, Justin?
Well, I have a soft spot for these small papers because that's where I started out before I came to the DNC. I was at the Citizen in Auburn, which I think that may be about 10,000 circulation. There were four of us in the news reporting wing. And actually, the Citizen won a Pulitzer back in 1930, a man named William O. Dapping. There was a prison break at the Auburn prison there, and he was on the scene. And that, to me, is kind of an interesting thread tying these things together. The topics that we're talking about, there's certain topics that don't come up as often in a large rural or even a medium rural area, and prisons are one because of where they tend to be situated. Agriculture is certainly one, and the water issues that Art Collin was talking about, and opioids certainly in Appalachia have been something like that. So I think that it's it's good to see the recognition coming and to these papers that are really perfectly positioned to cover things that are the most important in their communities.
I thought Art's comments about, you know, the Pulitzer Committee not necessarily making a political statement, but simply choosing what it thinks is the best work, is a fair one. But I think it can be both. I think it can be them choosing what they think is the most representative work for the awards, while also at least acknowledging that there are papers beyond the big cities and the big circulation newspapers, and that this kind of work is vital to our community. So, I mean, I guess you're not going to knock me off that perch. That's one of my themes this hour, and I really feel strongly about it. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, and, you know, that's something that bothers me when I read, you know, kind of the national prognosticators about the state of journalism, which is just an exhausting thing to do, and I try not to do it too much. But
does it depress you a little?
All of their premises are, they'll say, well, here's what the New York Times is doing, here's what Politico is doing, and here's what the Washington Post is doing, and therefore, here's the state of journalism in mm-hmm. the United States. And it's just, it couldn't be less representative of, not necessarily even all of the news sources that individual people are reading, but in different communities and the number of journalists throughout the country. I agree with you. It's important to be cognizant of that.
And so, when it comes to the future of the industry, does it depress you when you think more about that? I mean, I asked Eric about it. I asked Art about it. You know, are you more sanguine about the place of newspapers long term at all?
Well, I think that first of all, you need to I think it's a fact that your children and my children will not be picking up a bundle of paper off their front porch when they're old people. That seems like a trend. That doesn't particularly bother me. There's no reason why the news needs to be printed on paper and thrown on people's porches. I don't know. I think that one thing I think about is that we have kind of a very static view of the newspaper industry and say that ever since, you know, Gutenberg printed his first extra edition, it's always kind of been the same thing. And in fact, that's not true in terms of the reporting that gets done, in terms of the financial supports of newspapers. There has always been a lot of change going on in kind of the model that we're familiar with now, where, you know, the car dealerships and the classifieds pay the bills is not the only model, and that I think we're in an exquisitely uncomfortable situation because we haven't found the next model yet. But
yep.
The fact is that there always has been a next model, and it's normal in a sense that we don't know what it is. That doesn't make it any more pleasant to be living in that time.
Yeah, and so it's one thing to say, well, our kids, when they're old people, are not going to be picking up bundles of paper off their driveway, maybe the way that we do now. But who cares? They can consume in a lot of different ways. It doesn't have to be that way. It's another to say, are people going to pay for it? I don't care how we consume the news. I care that many of us don't want to pay for it anymore. And as an example, Eric Ayer told me that, you know, their piece, their work on opioids, especially the first major piece that came out, was the most shared piece they ever had on social media. Not clickbaity video or check out this funny thing. Yeah, it is an investigative piece of journalism. But most people who have read that work, my guess is, are not subscribing and are not helping fund his salary. So that's what I don't know how we get around.
But, you know, even in that area, I think as recently as 5 or 10 years ago, it seemed foolish for papers to think that they could institute paywalls. There had been no paywalls since the internet began in as newspapers embarked on that, I think the consensus was there's no possible way that's going to work. And it did work.
Because people won't stand for it? They won't use it?
People won't stand for it. It won't generate any revenue.
Right.
And I stay as far away from the revenue discussion
yeah,
as I possibly
I'm
can.
I'm with you, man. Yep.
But the fact is that almost every single newspaper in the country has an online paywall, and they appear to be generating some revenue. I don't know. So I think, and there was just recently a report, I think, I don't know if it's Pew or somebody does kind of a state of journalism polling thing every year, and it said that a much larger percentage of young people are paying for news. I think it went from, I don't know, 10 to 20%, something like that. So that you know, things change, and I don't know how they're going to change, but I have confidence that they will.
When Eric says that that's the most shared piece they've ever done, that gives me a lot of optimism, because for the cynics who say, well, people won't read stories, people won't read longer pieces, our attention spans are getting shorter. Well, if that were true, then that would not be the most shared piece and the most discussed item in their history. It would be some sort of lame viral video, but it's not. It's an investigative piece on opioids. And so for me, that is another little data point in the argument that if you produce great content, if you do great reporting, people will still read it.
Yeah, and I think, so I can tell you, for me personally, I believe the most read online story that I have ever done was a few years ago when a 12-year-old girl in East Rochester died by suicide. Mm. And that was a very resource-intensive reporting process. It took a long time, and I didn't do a lot of other stuff in the meantime. But it's an example of, yes, I did a lot of investigative work, but I think sometimes we have we say, you know, here's 30,000 words on campaign finance in New York, and if you're a good citizen, then you'll dutifully sit here and read the whole thing. And the reporting on things like opioids or things like teen mental health or, you know, even water quality in certain communities, it shows the reporter needs to be attentive to the fact that, you know, you do have to meet a person halfway. You can't just blather on about whatever it is. And when you get to that sweet spot of something that's substantive and meaningful to your community and holds their interest, then certainly that they'll pay for it.
Now, before I let you go here, one of the reasons I wanted you to come on and chat with us is, you know, you're a nice guy. You're you have questionable judgment as a sports fan, but I think you're an excellent reporter. And one of the things I always enjoy is when you roll out a series that you've been working on for a long time when it comes to education. You've done work on charter schools, you've done work on opt-outs. You know, I don't know anybody who I would go to before you on those matters. And one thing that we've seen go away from newsrooms, at least on commercial broadcast side, I don't know about print journalism, is sort of a lack of an emphasis on beats anymore. I think that's so important. Can you just give our listeners a sense for, you know, not every story you do is the same. Sometimes you'll turn around a story in a few days or a day. Sometimes you'll work on a story for months or up to a year. But what the process can be like for you and how intensive that can be?
Yeah, well, it's just like anything else in the world. The more you do something, the more that you know about it. And for me, the most fulfilling thing about having the education beat that I've been on for a number of years now is every story that you do, you're adding, hopefully, to the number of people who trust you, who have seen their name and their work reflected in the newspaper in a way that seems fair and accurate to them. And they're then more willing to come to you proactively and have that appreciation of local news that we're talking about. I had a story a while ago I did about a school leader who faced some charges, allegations from people in the school. And I did a story, and several other local news outlets did a story. And mine was different from theirs. It was longer. It had a little bit more substance and representing both sides. And the person didn't come out like an angel in it, but they contacted me afterward and said, I appreciated the time that you put into this, and seeing the three or four pieces kind of side by side and being at the center of all of them gave me an appreciation for the extra time and expertise that went into yours. And it made me think of how that plays out in other stories that I'm not personally involved in, where I think I may be getting a full story, but maybe there's only part of it. So it's the most important thing for me about being on a beat is having an opportunity to build trust over time, and the more conversations you have with somebody, the better information you will get and the better you get at conveying it.
Well, I think you do it very, very well. I enjoyed hearing Art Cullen say that, you know, he doesn't get invited to all the dinner parties, you know, and all, but that's not why you do it. And I think sometimes the public has a misconception about that. But I really enjoyed hearing that from him, among other things. And thanks for helping us wrap this conversation. Thank you for the work that you and your colleagues do. And I suspect eventually it'll be you know, I wouldn't be that surprised if a Pulitzer lands in Rochester, but we'll see.
You know, Evan, we've been on here talking about newspapers so many times. I feel like we need to have some kind of ceremony to make you an honorary print journalist. The next time I come in, I'm going to bring a mustard stained tie.
Yes, man.
And some illegible notebooks for you.
I love print journalism, and I don't care what anyone says. Justin Murphy from the Democrat and Chronicle. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
This has been an interesting hour with the Pulitzer winners from 2017. Our thanks to Art Cullen, Eric Ayer, and Justin Murphy from the Storm Lake Times, from the Charleston Gazette Mail, and from the Democrat and Chronicle. Our thanks to you for listening. Have a great afternoon, and we'll talk to you later this week right here on member-supported public radio.